Picture to yourself an immense amphitheatre such as nature only could create. Before you lies a broad extended plain bounded by a range of mountains whose summits are covered with tall and ancient woods. The meadows are bright with flowers and produce trefoil and other kinds of herbage as fine and tender as if it were but just sprung up, for all the soil is refreshed by never-failing streams. You would fancy that not a real, but some imaginary landscape painted by the most exquisite pencil lay before you. Such an harmonious variety of beautiful objects meets the eye, whichever way it turns. My house, although at the foot of the hill, commands as good a view as if it stood on its brow, yet you approach by so gentle and gradual a rise that you find yourself on high ground without perceiving you have been making an ascent.
You are listening to a podcast about building cities. I'm George Gingell.
And I'm Luke Jones. George, who would live in a house like that?
Oh, could it be Pliny?
Could it be?
The full name.
Yeah.
He's got a very long, quite silly name, which he sort of... Romans often got more names as they got older, and he really... Anyway, the sort of cut-down version is Gaius Plinius Caecilius Secundus, so...
Pliny the Younger. And he's describing the landscape surrounding his villa in Tuscany, which is set out in his letters, which are the thing for which he's famous. The letters cover all sorts of things, but we're focusing on the two which talk about his villas, one in Laurentum and one in Tusculum. And they set out something like a first century Roman vision of the good life, or at least the good life for the incredibly wealthy elite. Before we start, let's talk about who he is. So, George, can you give us a quick description of Pliny the Younger, his life and his station?
He's an elite Roman writer. In his own day, he was known as a lawyer and then later a politician, statesman. He is living at the high point of the Roman Empire. Most of the writings are written under Trajan. But his life had gone from being born in the time of Nero, living through civil war in his youth, rising up under the Flavian dynasty, Vespasian, gets his first big break. He has more or less a speechwriter for Domitian. He's the imperial quaestor.
Yeah, this is the rather troubled Emperor Domitian.
Domitian, yes. If you are an elite Roman, which I'm sure is the people you would naturally sympathise with, he's rather bad because he kills rather a lot of them. He's prone to sort of, he did all sorts of, lots of japes, like inviting people to dinner, telling them, and like they arrive and everything's in black mourning. And they're sort of, nervous-looking man with an axe waiting around the corner, and then gives them a long, lavish dinner, and then tells them it's all fine, they're not going to be executed afterwards. Or, sometimes, the other way round. Say, I've got a special surprise for you. You come over, and the special surprise is, you're going to be killed! Anyway, he doesn't get a very good rap from the people who came after him on account of killing rather a lot of them. But it was high time. It was great days for Pliny. He managed to, all his elders and betters being bumped off in a rapid succession, managed to scale right through the heights of the administration as a dependable defender of Domitian.
Yeah, striding down the cursus honorum.
Striding, yeah. Yeah, goes through all the ranks. But also manages to make the transition.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sort of shady dealings. Domitian's assassinated, and they bring in a sort of slightly doddering old emperor to try and keep the peace.
Yeah, this is Nerva.
For a little bit. And Pliny manages to get in with him, and then in with his young, dynamic military successor, Trajan. Who uses a bit and then sends him out to be a governor in Bithynia, which is a good posting, but not the best.
So Trajan, when you see maps of the Roman Empire at its greatest extent, it's at this point.
Yes, because for about 3 years, he'd conquered what's basically Iraq, and then died, and then Hadrian gave it up because it wasn't really defensible.
But this is a
golden age, both for the empire as a state and in its power, and it's also a golden age of the arts and culture and writing.
We should say something, which is that he's Pliny the Younger for a reason. He has a famous uncle.
Yeah, his mother's brother, his mother's elder brother, was Pliny the Elder. So his family generally are from the sort of second rung of the aristocracy, but very rich.
Yeah,
on that. they're not quite the sort of old money. And his uncle is famous for writing this sort of huge encyclopedia. Deals with everything from how many testicles an albatross has to, what to do with various sorts of rocks. And was famous in his day and was known as a learned figure. And was a sort of... the reason he's... I think that probably the thing... If anyone knows anything about him, they know that he wrote about Vesuvius, where he died.
Yeah, he witnessed the eruption of Vesuvius.
Fatally,
yes. Rather too close. He was in a boat.
Yeah, there's a really good one of the famous letters that we're not going to talk about really, except that we're doing it now. From Tacitus asks. So Tacitus, who's another Roman writer, military historian, who's actually rather more successful as a statesman than he gets all the jobs sort of one notch just ahead of Pliny 5 years earlier. So he gets the best governorship. Yeah. He also has a dashing military career. And one of the things he's known for is the description of the death of his uncle. And he's sort of... it's got a lot of good bits. Pliny doesn't go to the volcano, the younger, because he has to do his homework. He has to write his... He has to read Virgil, I think. And he's sort of copying that out. But he hears that his uncle's got... everyone has gone into a flap except for the elder, who wants to go and look at the volcano.
Yeah.
And then they go there. And then he decides it's all fine. And they go to sleep, get up the next morning, decide to go to the beach, and die in the fumes. And you can sort of read it both ways. Superficially, you're meant to read the story as like... scholarly, young Pliny, dashing, brave, intellectual Pliny the Elder. But they both look like doddering idiots who've got no idea of what's going on. even the slightest hint of sort of close reading, you realise that no one knows what on earth they're talking about. But it's a good sort of exciting bit, and good for teaching the kids.
Don't play with volcanoes.
Umbrella pine.
So they think the point which is really important to get is that the empire is incredibly secure, it's incredibly wealthy, the elite are amassing huge wealth which is flowing in from all of these places like Egypt and other parts of the empire. It's all running extremely well, and it means that in the context of these villas that we're going to talk about, Italy is incredibly safe and incredibly
confident
secure.
Confident and rich. Confident not only in their physical position and their commercial position, but also in their place in the world, their superiority.
Yeah.
And that they are the greatest men in the greatest age ever.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, the mid-19th century in Britain. It's the sort of, we are really, not only are we, physically the top, we're also morally, culturally where it's at.
And should we talk about what a villa is?
Yeah, I think that's worth mentioning. It's a term which, on the surface, over time has been used to describe quite different things.
Yeah.
The most obvious thing to say about it is a big house in the country.
Yeah.
Away from the city that you retreat to.
Yeah, it's the kind of it's a house for experiencing and enjoying a kind of idealized version of the countryside, and it's for enjoyment and relaxation principally. Yeah.
So these Roman ones, and one of them, the Laurentidium, how do you pronounce it?
The
Laurentine villa is just out of Rome. It's a day's slow walk
yeah.
out of Rome, or presumably an hour and a half on the horse
yeah,
in good weather. So it's really suburban. And I think if you imagine the countryside that had formerly been sort of feeding Rome, once that duty is taken over by Egypt and Sicily, it being sort of filled up with kind of picturesque villas.
Yeah.
A sort of villa suburbia.
Yeah.
But not a suburbia of the middle class. This is a suburbia of the plutocrats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like one of these things, like, I don't know, the, you know, some of these parts of...
Like the Moscow Ring Road. All the dictators go and live there.
Yeah. Or like, you know, like the Hamptons or like some of these places on Long Island, like where there's only millionaires.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
houses.
Earlier, I'm not sure if we'll ever release it, but we talked about Strawberry Hill.
Yeah.
It's not one of our better episodes. No. but it's a bit like that bit. It's that bit where, like, they're supposedly in the countryside, but, like, the garden of one villa ends and the garden of the next villa starts in reality. And you sort of get that a bit in the descriptions. There's this sort of villa landscape, which is kind of like fake. It's in one sense trying to harken back to agricultural wealth and the sort of rugged Roman farmer that built the state. But in another way, it's jolly summer houses with lots of, you know, playful retreats.
Well, let's talk about the Laurentine Villa. So this is the first of the two villas which he talks about. And as you say, it's the one which is close to the city. It's one which he could retreat to during the, like, outside of holidays or during the winter. He could ride out of Rome and go there. And it's by the sea. And as you say, he describes this this villa landscape which it's in. He talks about this kind of pleasant sprinkling of villas and the fact that he can see all of these other villas from his villa.
Yeah, the first thing to say is that, you know, this is a guy who's got a proper job and is working, I nearly said in London. But no, it's not London, it's Rome.
Rome.
He's working in Rome, you know, as a lawyer and can sort of come up for the weekend. I think you've got to imagine it like that. Although he probably took quite a lot of time off, I think.
Yeah.
And then the next qualities, which are really thick in the description, are those of the landscape and the way it sits between the country and the sea.
Yeah.
And relates to, you know, the village and the road and the sort of plants.
Yeah. So the whole, the design of the villa and the way in which he describes it is really... In a way, he talks about it almost as this sort of journey from Rome to the sea, where the villa is kind of mediating the last part of that journey.
Yeah, or also a journey from Rome to dinner via...
porticos.
Via porticos. The sea, it's there, but it's sort of, it's glimpsed.
Yeah.
There's little, like, chinks, so you sort of, you're coming, he starts by coming up the dusty road, and you see, you know, the villa, and you go through the various stages, and I think you see the Roman interest in transitions. It's a lovely climate, so outside is very good.
Well, maybe we should do a little reading. I think that a feature of these descriptions is that he always talks about the situation of the villa in the landscape before describing what any of the rooms are actually like to be in. But yeah, let's talk about how you arrive. It goes like this. The courtyard in front is plain but not mean, through which you enter porticos shaped into the form of the letter D, enclosing a small but cheerful area between. From the middle of these porticos, you pass into a bright, pleasant inner court, and out of that into a handsome hall running out towards the seashore, so that when there is a southwest breeze, it is gently washed with the waves, which spend themselves at its base. On every side of this hall, there are either folding doors or windows equally large, by which means you have a view from the front and the two sides of three different seas, as it were. From the back, you see the middle court, the portico, and the area, and from another point, you look through the portico into the courtyard and out upon the woods and distant mountains beyond.
So the first bit of where you get there is how you approach. And villas are places that you go to.
Yeah.
He's not even living there. But then once he's there, there's that interest in being in a place and seeing the surrounding, some of which are immediate and some of which are the sort of powerful forces of nature, and appreciating them.
Yeah.
Like when we were first discussing it, you sort of had his descriptions as a bit like, there's a problem that he's not very direct about what, like, the building, they're not architectural descriptions.
No.
But they're also not descriptions of sort of consumer gadgetry. I mean, there are moments where it's like that, but it's a lot description of how much you can take, how much the architecture allows you to take from the landscape.
Yeah.
And the inner landscape of the inside of the villa, the courtyards and gardens, become elements just as the sea and the mountains.
It's a real problem of it's genuinely quite difficult to keep in your mind all of the parts which he's describing, because there are so many of them. They're very, very, I don't know if
there's,
they're necessarily
abundance.
They're not necessarily complex, but they're made up of a lot of different elements, and that each one has as its kind of reason for being that it allows you to look at a particular view, or to be kind of warmed by the sun in a particular way, or to be kind of, you know, washed by the breeze or whatever. And there's this like massive duplication of elements as well, so you very quickly lose count of the number of bedrooms or dining rooms or porticos or halls.
There's definitely a device which is not just in the descriptions of villas, but I think runs through it, which is a superabundance of nice things.
Mm.
Sort of describing the feeling of sun, or the breeze of the sea, and the little bit of sea spray that comes into the garden. And there's so many of these descriptions, and they're all sort of nice feelings. It's much more, I think, about creating a sense of sort of a pleasurable bodily sense of being in a place, rather than having a coherent and comprehensible description of a building.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The way in which everything is presented to you is that you're wandering. Mm.
You're in your body as well.
It's a kind of bodily wandering experience, going through the various spaces of the building in order, in the sense that you go from one to the next one adjacent, but essentially arbitrary in terms of the choice of whether you turn left or right at a particular point, or where you start from and where you end.
Yeah, the buildings are very wandering, but Roman villas were a bit like that. I'm rambling, but another bit of the description is that he, in other villas, there's quite a few letters that describe, he starts in a place, he's either a traveller going to the villa, or he's waking up in the dark at night, and, you know, will spend time in the dark and then open the blinds, and then the world is unfolded.
Yeah.
And I think part of that, so what do I mean? What I mean is that something that he's really prizing is this unfolding of different sensations, which are bodily sensations, which can exist right up at your face. You know, that you're in the dark, there's this little object, or immediately can zoom out right to the distant mountains.
Yeah. I think a thing that we'll see as we go through these, the more of these texts that we read, the more you see that there's something very tantalizing about them. But there are also things which are quite frustrating about them.
They're not a good read.
No, they're not a good read. I think, in a minute I might do a reading of another bit, and we can see how quickly we get lost in terms of where we where we are.
There are so many problems.
Yeah.
With the writing that it's almost,
it's a real problem. I think that it's really the closest thing that we have to a description of a sort of idealized version of, like, living in a house. So we have a bit of a sense of, like, what it's like to live in a house, and what you do there, and what you prize, and what you value, and what kind of experiences you want to have. But it's also still quite thin. And there are a lot of rooms where he just tells you what it is, and you don't really have a clear sense of what it would be
and
for.
And then I've got another dining room, and then you walk out, and there's a room off this corridor. And that room is normally a bedroom and sometimes a dining room, and it's big and lovely.
Sometimes you'll just say, where there is a room warmed by the sun.
Yeah. Or, and then by that room, there's another room which is gently warmed by pipes of an appropriate temperature. So that it is neither too hot nor too cold.
Yeah. It is a bit like that.
And every statement is, there's something, you know. The house is is modest, but grand.
Yeah.
Not so large that it's expensive to keep up, but more than adequate for anyone's needs.
Yes. Yeah, he's always...
Except that, like, any of the examples we give are nowhere near as long as they really are in the piece, because actually they ramble on and on and on.
So let's do a little bit... Let's follow Pliny a little bit further, and we'll see if we can keep up with him. So here you go. Adjoining this angle is a room forming the segment of a circle, the windows of which are so arranged as to get the sun all through the day. In the walls are contrived a sort of cases, containing a collection of authors who can never be read too often. Next to this is a bedroom, connected with it by a raised passage furnished with pipes, which supply, at a wholesome temperature, and distribute to all parts of the room the heat they receive. Beyond this is a bedroom with an anteroom, the height of which renders it cool in summer. Its thick walls warm in winter, for it is sheltered every way from the winds. From thence you enter into the wide and spacious cooling room belonging to the bath, from the opposite walls of which are two curved basins, so to speak, which are more than large enough if you consider that the sea is close at hand. Adjacent to this is the anointing room, then the sweating room, and beyond that the bath heating room. Adjoining are two little other bathrooms, elegantly rather than sumptuously fitted up. Annexed to them is a warm bath of wonderful construction, in which one can swim and take a view of the sea at the same time. Not far from this stands the tennis court, which lies open to the warmth of the afternoon sun. From thence you go up a sort of turret, which has two rooms below, with the same number above, besides a dining room commanding a very extensive lookout to the sea, the coast, and the beautiful villas scattered along the shoreline. I forgot about the tennis court. I think the tennis court is an artifact of the translation. I don't think they had tennis in Roman times.
No, yeah. There's another bit where he talks about how everything is capital.
Yeah, I think we're reading...
absolutely capital!
It reads like it's translated by a sort of 16-year-old boy in about 1905.
Yeah, I think this was someone's Latin homework and subsequently fallen into the public domain. Interest in all of this sort of stuff peaked around 1900 and has been in a pretty serious decline since then. I struggled not only to understand, but to keep paying attention while you were reading that. And I've read it before.
Yeah. It is a bit like that.
You start drifting off very, very quickly.
Yeah. But actually, if you do try and stay with it, there are these fascinating little moments. I think that I'm interested in these strange little towers which you go out to enjoy a view of the sea and capture the winter sun.
They remind me of the sweetbread towers at Hardwick Hall, where supposedly, which is a tiny little turret on the top, where you're meant to go up and eat fried pancreas.
Yes.
And survey the hunting landscape, which seems such an esoteric thing, but people did build these things. And I think the whole purpose of the villa, once you've established the purpose of the villa is delight, then strange little esoteric bits of architecture make complete sense.
Yeah. One thing that is noticeable during the description is that by far the most common kind of public room is the dining room. And there are at least four. There's the one which is large, warm and light. There's this special one we've alluded to, which is overlooking the sea from up high. There is a low down hidden one underneath a granary where you can hide from storms. And there is an isolated one with a garden view. So this is reflective of one of the main things which you would do with a house like this, which is to entertain.
Yeah, and the entertaining spaces are the garden for the day, and everything after about 2 o'clock is dining room. And dining room is big complicated meal and then entertainment and party time. They're the functional bit. All Roman rich houses in cities or in the country or everywhere would have at least one, and it would always be the most important room. It's the room where everything goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, and the dining rooms, slightly to cover old ground again, but they very much like capture this sense of the house, that you have places in the villa to look out at the landscape.
Yeah.
That there's an interesting essay by James Ackerman called The Villa as a Paradigm, and which we might talk a bit more about later. But one of the things he does is to define these two different approaches to how you locate a villa in a landscape. That a villa is obviously about this contact with idealized nature, and it's in this very kind of strong relationship with the nature. And then you have these two options, one of which is to put something which is very unnatural in there as a kind of strong contrast with the rolling, flowing landscape. So something, many houses by Palladio, for instance, are like this. So you put like a cubic sort of platonic kind of volume at the top of a very beautiful hill, or you put something which is very, very clearly symmetrical, which then offsets these asymmetrical rolling wooden wooded hills behind it, or something like that. And obviously the other approach is to do something which is itself very organic, which has an irregular plan, which kind of sort of goes off in different directions and kind of sort of arbitrarily kind of ends and becomes part of the landscape itself.
You always have elements which are artificial. I think you're alluding to the fact that the Roman villas that we're looking at here seem more like a journey. You go in, it's not organized symmetrically in plan. It's organized around routes through that go to places with views and sensations.
Yeah.
But there are also views that are composed of a mixture of, you know, porticos and tough built buildings,
yeah,
and delights, and, you know, the artificial immediate landscape, which is supposed, he sort of talks about blending into the agricultural landscape behind.
Yes, all the box hedges cut to the shapes of animals.
Yeah, facing each other in pairs. And, you know, we can't have this. Yeah, there's lots of like ridiculous, and his sort of fake farms.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, but also bits of like kitchen gardens, which he's still very proud of. Everywhere has a like clipped walk. But he never talks about what it looks like from the outside.
Yeah.
That doesn't really matter.
No.
You see it's there, but it's the sort of, it's the landscape within the house that I think is really key.
Should we talk, maybe we should define a few more of the elements that we're working with here in terms of the overall, like what are some of the elements in the composition? We have porticos, which are these like, it's a roof with columns.
Yeah. I mean, what he's talking about is like a semicircle with columns. Semicircle, yeah, in plan with columns.
And
we know what they look like.
It has a kind of a door. There's a sort of a door at the back and the columns are at the front.
Yeah, it's a porch.
Yeah. And then there are courtyards, which tend to also be colonnaded.
Yeah. So Roman houses, even rich ones, didn't tend to have any glass in the windows. And they didn't really have that much by way of windows. Early on, there were no windows. And they would have some, and they would be shutters or nothing.
Yeah.
And so the courtyard space, which is partially covered with a big hole in the roof, is actually where you do most of the stuff. You do most of your work in the portico.
Yeah.
In the, you know, bits surrounding. So if you think about it as the barrier between what's inside and outside is much less distinct. There's always this, you are either really shut up, boxed in the dark,
yeah,
or it's very open.
Yeah.
Which works better, let's face it, in the Italian climate than here.
Yeah.
but you can also see why he's so obsessed with like staying warm and things like that.
Yeah. The warmth of the sun and the heating pipes and things.
Yeah. But it's you go through these semi-open, closed places into courtyards, and then from the courtyards into rooms.
Yeah.
And the gardens can be inward-facing gardens, which are like more open courtyards, or outward-facing ones, which are often
maybe a sort of colonnaded walk on one side, and then...
Yeah. Like, you have a like very formal, if you know what, sort of like a, you know, little box hedges and clipped sort of neat you know, very formal garden, and then beyond that, all sorts of things, and it sort of peters out into a landscape.
Should we talk about the villa? Even a villa as grand as this one is in many ways an evolution of a certain kind of original Roman house type.
Yeah.
So the original Roman house is...
Yeah, the Domus Italicum, I think.
Yeah.
It's called something like that. These are the, like, urban houses. And in short, you've got a street front, which has got a big door in it. And it might have some shops built into that wall. And then you go through the door, the big door, into a courtyard. And in the courtyard, which is probably colonnaded, it's got a hole in the roof, but yeah, it's sort of semi-in and out. That's probably where most of the activity goes on, the sort of business end of the house. It's where you greet people. It's also literally, if you were like, had a weaving business, it's where people do the weaving. Off that, bedrooms. And at the back, the little family shrines, which are just sort of tucked into a corner of the courtyard. And you might also have wooden plaques, which would sort of say, you know, the important members of the family, or the portraits and things like that are all sort of tucked away in that corner. Beyond them, the dining room, which operates...
So this is at the side of the courtyard furthest from the street.
Yeah, it's what you're facing as you come in. So you come in and then there's all this sort of business stuff. And then between the courtyard and the garden, the dining room, which sort of holds up the barrier.
Yeah.
And there may be service rooms off that, kitchens and things. But that's the sort of big, swanky, where you put your money. And then the garden, which is meant to be this little oasis at the back. And the old houses, that was more or less it.
Yeah.
The indoor spaces are small and dark and not very important. You know, the bedrooms in plan are more or less identical to the storerooms. They're not where... The important spaces are oddly those which aren't really indoors.
Yeah.
The garden and the dining room are the prestigious ones, and the courtyard's where everything goes on.
Yeah. So it's these kind of two open spaces are the thing which the house is organised around, the courtyard and then the garden at the back.
Yeah, and as time goes on, that's the sort of traditional... solid Roman farmer who they all wanted to emulate but didn't really.
Yeah.
And then they start to get richer and start to loosen up, and you start to get stories coming in, as in you get another floor. People start showing off. They might do big gardens or have sort of build things onto this. And that house is usually in there somewhere, but it becomes sort of extended. And then if you take that house out of the city and make it in the countryside as a villa, there's still some of the notions, but you're no longer doing that business activity.
Yeah.
The courtyard is sort of moved to the back and becomes a bit more perfunctory. You're no longer entertaining all your clients. And it becomes, instead of being focused around this sort of logical townhouse, it becomes... these extended, they still know the ideas of porticos and things, but it becomes this extended landscape of innovation and trying stuff out and pleasure, and the architecture is expressive rather than purposeful.
Yeah. Well, should we talk about the other house?
Tuscan.
Yeah. So Pliny had
loads of houses. There's a really short essay, which we... about like how, which is the comic and tragic, is that he was born up in Comum.
Yeah.
He was born in Comum. And he had he says, these are two of my villas in Comum.
Yeah.
There are many others. And he calls them the tragic and comic villas. And the tragic is tragic because it's up on a rock. And the comic is comic because it's down by the water. And then that's almost it for the letter.
It's a bit of a one line. So, and actually, I mean, there are some people who think that the two villas described in these letters actually didn't exist.
And
they're a kind of a composite of a bunch of other houses that he had.
Yeah. How real any of this is. The purpose of the letters is to show him off as an elegant, cultured, thinking man.
Yeah.
Who defines taste and decency. And one part of that is how you live, and you live in houses, so he describes houses.
Do you want to say anything about the way in which he lives? So that there are particular things which he doesn't do. He doesn't do dancing girls.
No, yeah. Not for me. The parties where the host will hire dancing girls. I only hire people to read poetry.
Yeah.
And discuss philosophy.
Yeah, which he does with his family and close friends.
Yeah, but also he complains that nobody's going to all the literary seminars. And without him, there wouldn't be any organised at all.
So the other house is his villa in Tuscany, which is much further away from Rome. It's up in the mountains. And it's described much more as a place to spend extended periods of time for a kind of a holiday or a breakaway. It's still made up of the same kind of set of elements, these porticos, these courtyards, this relationship to the landscape. But unlike the Laurentine villa, which is really quite bare, there's not very much of a sense which goes on in what goes on in the rooms. In this case, there are lots of descriptions of art. There are lots of descriptions of general luxury. We've alluded already to the box hedges in the shapes of animals. There are all sorts of entertainments which are alluded to. A lot of novelty and an awful lot of ostentation.
He's got his own racetrack on grounds. He's got like a little amphitheatre. He's got all sorts of stuff. Do you want the description?
Shall we do a little reading? So as ever in these, we kind of start in the middle of something, but we'll just go from where we are. At the upper end is an alcove of white marble, shaded with vines and supported by four small Christian columns. From this semicircular couch, the water, gushing up through several little pipes, as though pressed out by the weight of the persons who recline themselves upon it, falls into a stone cistern underneath, from whence it is received into a fine polished marble basin, so skillfully contrived that it is always full without ever overflowing. When I sup here, this basin serves as a table, the larger sort of dishes being placed around the margin, while the smaller ones swim around in the form of vessels and waterfowl.
Yeah, sort of like somewhere between the kind of rotating conveyor belt of Yo Sushi, with little wooden ducks, presumably with sort of little plates of things floating around in this bubbling pool.
With lark's tongues and...
lark's tongues in aspic, no doubt, and indescribable and peculiar bits of animals they didn't realise they owned, presented in complex ways.
Dining at this time was incredibly lavish.
Yeah, the Roman would achieve all his work by noon, and then devote most of the rest of the day to a meal.
Yeah.
In theory. And if you're eating it entirely off little carved wooden waterfowl bubbling around in a pool, you can probably see why.
It must get absolutely horrible. It will be full of, like, swimming around little cocktail sausages by the end of it.
Yeah, no, really gross. Fortunately, I think an army of slaves would come down and sort everything out for you. Which is, if you're ever wondering how anything is achieved, it's inevitably an army of slaves.
All of whom would be eating porridge.
Yeah, black bean soup.
Yeah.
I seem to remember a description of porridge of chickpeas.
Yeah.
Sisera. The first one that we were talking about, he notes that he doesn't have his own running water supply and is a bit disappointed by this, but says there's various other things we can do. We've got, you know, wells and stuff. And then where he does have a water supply, it's one of the real qualities of the site. I think part of the reason is that they were probably just much more... These are working farms as well. And I think without having... without having any of the conveniences of modern technology, these places are providing most of their own food in a landscape where they're also providing... So the luxury of sparkling water has a much deeper meaning, which is also part of the sort of idea of the landscape, the rich earth.
It also leads to there being these very, like, elaborate gardens.
Yeah, I mean, the people who read these things now are actually people interested in gardening design.
Yeah.
There's lots of although what they get from it, I have no idea. Yeah. But you'll find it on gardening websites rather than gardening websites and people learning Latin.
Yeah. I mean, we've alluded multiple times to the box hedge. He has a special slave who is like very good at box hedges. But yeah. He has this kind of curious status where most of the time he makes the box hedges in Pliny's name, but sometimes he's allowed to do it of his own name.
Yeah, but this is a classic form. That's what artists are meant to do. It's sort of an imitation of elite culture where the people who put out the coinage mainly do it for the emperor, and then like 1 in 10 they can do it in their own, or the people who carve sculptures will put themselves in the corners.
Yeah. I think that we can tell that this is a house more intended for holidays because
party house.
It's a bit of a party house, but in fact that the rooms which he spends most time describing are ones for being alone in. So they're these ones where you can have a lot.
The party is meant to go on without him.
Oh right, yeah.
Haven't you noticed?
Yeah. But
There's a lot of rooms which are, and this room is so far away from the house that when the party is going on, I can hardly hear it.
Yeah. So they're full of these places for him to read, to be alone, to kind of look at the gently waving branches of the trees and have a nap.
Read Plotinus and the Epicureans. I'm not sure how much. I think he just loves the idea of being cultured.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, the descriptions of the art are not very precise. But we learn that there are these rooms which are encrusted with marble, for example, that are full of carving. He doesn't really say what it's of. I think we have to make our own assumptions.
It's just sort of opulence, isn't it? He doesn't describe, at no point in any of his essays, in any of his letters, does he describe anything that we would regard as the great works of architecture or art of his day, which were really going on. This is the time when sort of the best Roman stuff is being made, the best buildings. He's not really interested.
Yeah.
He's interested in art as something as part of a kind of consumer culture.
Well, for him, it's all about literature, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, the great art is poetry. Like, head and shoulders above everything else.
And philosophy.
And philosophy, yeah, I guess to some extent. But, like, the ability to recite poetry and to have read all of the poets and have passed that on to
you've got to have a very good Homeric hexameter.
Yeah, and you've passed it on to your children. And, you know, that's sort of what kind of culture consists in.
And also, that's part of being... There are two parallel paths of being a great Roman. You can be a military man, or you can be a man of letters, which is someone who writes poetry, prosecutes legal action, and does politics.
Yeah.
And they are the sort of same thing. They're all it's a literary culture, which is a culture where the idea of literature is the same as the idea of power and administration. Rather as sort of in China, you've got this idea that what will make you good, you have to pass the exam, which is an exam about incomprehensible classic literature. This small coterie of elites justify their rule because they are educated, know the classics, and can talk and persuade. And literature is the highest art because it's the art of persuading and moving people. And it's that process. The building, in a way, is also sort of moving and convincing people.
Well, I think let's leave Pliny now lying on his couch, listening to the pleasing murmur of the waters. And maybe talk a little bit about why these letters are still interesting and why the idea of the... maybe some of the continuing story of the idea of the villa. As we alluded to, one of the issues is that it's quite hard to build up a coherent mental picture of what this villa would look like, except for the fact that it's very complicated. We don't know No one has excavated either of these. We don't know exactly where they are, although that they have excavated villas which are sort of vaguely similar. There's a good drawing in the essay I mentioned of a villa in Sicily, which is on something like a similar kind of scale, if a little bit later.
Yeah, and what surprises people who are used to classical architecture is that it's not like neoclassical at all, other than it uses columns. Yeah, the sort of basic shapes are the same, but it's much freer, much stranger, organic, asymmetrical, going off in all sorts of funny angles.
Yeah, we'll put this up. It's a really nice drawing. It has this big central courtyard, but the elements around it are going off at all sorts of different angles. They're of all different kinds and sizes. I'm not sure I could identify very clearly what any of them are for, except that it was probably some kind of
fun.
Fun.
It's the delight in novelty and changing forms, and that's right at the end of the period when they're like really just trying out new things. You know, they've got concrete.
Yeah.
What can we do with concrete? Well,
we can do all kinds
of things. Loads of stuff.
So the people who are starting to look at these letters, well, I mean, kind of historically, when people start getting really interested in them again is when people start being interested in classical architecture again. And as you say, they struggle with this fact that the villas are actually not very classical in the way that they've tended to define classicism, because they're asymmetrical, because they're chaotic seeming in their plan, because they seem to sort of...
Yeah, there's a funny thing that the only writer we have, Vitruvius, actually thinks symmetry is very important.
Yeah.
So there's one writer on architecture from the classical world, and he's earlier than this. He's not very bright, and he's quite often wrong. And he mainly writes about like military things.
Yeah. It like tells you about lots and lots of bits, but without giving you any sense at all of what you might do with them.
Yeah. He's got a few little anecdotes, but it's mainly sort of lists of stuff.
Lots of ingredients, like, yeah, you know, sand and...
Yeah, opus quadratum.
Yeah.
Opus and certum. You know, you sort of learn a lot about construction terms.
Yeah.
But there is some interesting stuff about different types of temples and different types of basilicas. The only things that we know he actually made are a couple of basilicas. These are the public town hall buildings. Anyway, we're drifting off. He's not very good. Pliny's almost the only other person who talks about buildings, and he talks about them in a very abstract way.
Yeah.
Which has allowed people to do almost whatever they want with it, which yeah, was great for them.
So, after people have been reading them for a bit, they start trying to reconstruct the design. And this is a kind of diversion and pastime for architects. But it tends to reflect their own view of what classical architecture is or what it should be.
It's a bit of a shame, really. It went from, in the early days, it's sort of architects thinking this is going to be great and doing whatever they like and sort of making the description work. And it's slowly become people actually trying to reconstruct it, which tend to be much weaker because there really isn't enough to go on.
Okay. So you get one by Scamozzi, who was from 1548 onwards, and it's completely symmetrical on one axis. Everything has been kind of regularized into this series of similarly sized and kind of harmoniously proportioned rooms. The whole assemblage makes a sort of big rectangle in plan. There is a sort of big rectangular courtyard, a big circular courtyard with a sort of a compass in it in the middle, which I guess is some sort of...
It's like learning geometry. Yeah. We like that.
And then there's another courtyard, and then there are various stairs. The towers, which Pliny... refers to in this way, which sort of suggests that they just kind of appear somewhere rather randomly, have been integrated so that they're in the centre of the main mass of the building. and kind of define it.
Yeah, he's done a Renaissance building.
He's done a Renaissance building.
Which is absolutely not... It doesn't work with the description, even. But it's definitely not what they were doing at the time. There's a funny thing that goes on in the Renaissance, which is that both the Romans and the Renaissance are very interested in geometry. But the Romans like sort of like plays of dissonance and a harmony. They like something to they like things to some things to jar and some things to resolve. Whereas the Renaissance is very much about everything being completely resolved. You have no funny angles. You have no they would never do the thing in the Pantheon, which is where you have two. How on earth am I going to describe that? Let's just take it out. But I'll describe it for you.
Yeah.
So the like bit that was taken out.
Oh, so we just say what it is. So the Pantheon.
So the Pantheon's this amazing building in Rome. Best Roman building?
I think arguably. It's built around this time, isn't it?
It's built just afterwards. It's built by Hadrian.
Yeah, it's built the second... Yeah, Hadrian builds it the second time, doesn't he?
It would have been a bulk standard, completely different and much... I mean, it says rebuilt, you know, was built by Marcus Agrippa. That's a modesty topos. It was entirely built by Hadrian.
Yeah.
I think that would be the better way to think of it.
Else?
It's one huge cylindrical room with a dome, which is a massive dome, by far the biggest one ever built at the time, with one big window in it. And it's got a lot of the plays of singular geometry. If like the circle of the dome was carried on, it would just touch the floor. So it's this sort of combination of square, sphere, and cylinder.
Yeah.
And there's lots of complicated plays of sort of geometry about it. But it does something which the Renaissance found very troubling, to the point where they stripped it out because they thought someone must have done something wrong. Which is that there are coffers. There are these sort of square insets into the dome, and there's a certain number of those, which I can't remember. And then the next layer down, there were these decorative marble panels. But they were done in such a ratio that...
they don't line up.
They were interferometric. Like, they lined up only at two places, and then were off by varying amounts all the way around. Romans love that sort of thing, because it's like this like resolved, unresolved variation. This was very troubling.
Yeah.
And so they stripped them out and replaced them with something that matched up.
Something which was properly Roman in the way they understood it.
Yeah. Except they left one panel in place.
Yeah, you could see what they'd done. I hope
they were proud of them.
So obviously this reconstruction goes on. There's a slightly more convincing one by a French architect called Louis-Pierre Audebourg. And his is... it's a little bit more kind of... What is it like? Well, for one thing, the towers seem a lot more towery. It reads much more as like an assemblage of these quite different... elements which don't really, they're not in the Scamozzi one. It's like he's really laboring to make it all hang together as a single building and to have the sort of the same type of columns and the sort of ratios between everything, whereas in this one there's like a kind of a columny bit with these various porticos, and then there's a bit which doesn't have any columns, which actually looks sort of semi-fortified with these high up windows. And then there are the towers, which are these huge, big kind of piles of rusticated stone with these little things on the top which look like tiny little temples. So this was done around the start of the 19th century.
And what's happened between those two, which is quite a long time, is they've actually dug up some fairly well-preserved real villas, particularly in Pompeii, where there are some that are quite well preserved up to sort of halfway up the first floor.
Yeah.
And so they sort of know what they should look like, actually, and they know that they weren't this thing of like being neat and classical.
Yeah.
And they've got something to go on.
And we've also passed through, we've kind of elided several historical epochs of architecture. We've kind of gone
300 years.
We've gone from the kind of late
you know what they say, 300 years is a long time in architecture.
We've gone from the sort of the late Renaissance into like over the kind of like massiveness and strangeness and movement of the Baroque. And the kind of lightness of sort of Rococo and things. And then we're now like well into this much more historically informed, like quite intellectual neoclassicism.
Yeah, there's about 150 years of historical revival after historical revival, which both sort of invigorates and stultifies creative culture across Europe.
But there's this kind of strong interest in these they're quite startling and quite strange effects of these different historical elements being juxtaposed together as well.
Yeah, something that was great for radical people, something that was great about the Romans is that they were radical and jarring and odd. And a lot of people who want to go back to the past want to do it to be radical. And so there's the sort of second, like, post-Renaissance view. Oh, the Romans are radical in this sort of way. We can make something of that.
Probably the most famous architect to have taken this on as a problem is Carl Friedrich Schinkel, who's almost a contemporary of Oudebourg, actually, like 1780s onwards. And he did both of the villas. He did reconstructions of both of them. His one, and there, I think that the other thing which makes these ones really interesting is that he was like exceptionally interested in sort of like draftsmanship and perspective and representing these buildings in a way which is like very atmospheric and lifelike and extremely beautiful to look at. So the views of these are really amazing.
His office, this is something people should look up. Most of the drawings weren't by him, although he was a pretty good painter. He, by the way, like, thing to say about Schinkel is that he is the sort of court, he organises culture for the Prussian court, so he does everything.
In the early 19th century.
Yeah, the early 19th century when Prussia's kind of trying to come out as a great power. And he's a painter and does all that, but he also has a big office. He's got a lot of money, does big projects, and he's got people who are trained up, and there's one guy who does the most elaborate ruling pen perspectives sort of ever made, and there's another guy who does the most precise sort of watercolor things, and there's another guy who does etchings.
It's a bit like Foster.
Yeah.
Norman Foster has an office a bit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So his depiction of the Laurentine villa has you see it from out at sea. You see the whole thing reflected in the blue of the ocean. And it's this very, very, as you say, like incredibly fine, detailed perspective. It looks a bit Prussian.
Yes.
Very severe.
Yeah.
And then his version of the Tuscan villa, which, like, again, you see with these like amazing sort of sublime pile of mountains and forested slopes and clouds behind it, has this sort of double-decker colonnade with a big one at the bottom and a slightly smaller one, which I think you're meant to read kind of as a loggia above it. And, or, you know, again, these various sorts of elements which are arranged into something which is quite a lot more compact or less linear and more of a sort of a mass.
Part of the reason why he's doing these, and I think they're done fairly early on, is because his project, fairly early on in terms of him at the Prussian court, is that his project is, we are going to create Prussia as a great nation.
Oh yeah.
Having been a sort of swamp, with a small number of Germans ruling over a large native unruly peasantry, into a great sophisticated powerhouse of culture that's going to have its own take on the world, and people are going to listen to what Prussia has to say. And a way of doing that is by taking antiquity, claiming it for your own, we are the most authentically antique, and also sort of pushing that a bit into the mold of what it was that they were doing at that time. Laying the rhetorical ground for what he was going to do architecturally and as a salonist subsequently.
I mean, Rome is like the reference above all other references for the project of like imperial
the right, kind of the second self-creation Reich.
And statehood. Yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
is the Second Reich.
Yeah.
So, oh yeah, so I mean,
yeah. For those who don't know, like obviously Prussia later in the 19th century would give birth to the kind of the German state, you know, by taking over everything else.
They weren't quite thinking about it, but they would be thinking about it
within about
20 years later.
Yeah. Should we talk about some? So we do know a little bit about some other Roman houses, and quite an interesting comparison, obviously on a vastly larger scale than this, is Hadrian's Villa.
Which is in Tivoli,
yeah.
Which is outside Rome, not very far,
yeah.
But in the other direction, it was a very early, it was a very old sort of noble city that was conquered very early on by the Romans, and then subsequent to that's where they got their stone from. But it's now got a beautiful temple and this amazing villa in it.
I think one of the things which is interesting about it is that it shares some of the kind of the aspiration for it. Is in certain ways a bit like Pliny's for his Tuscan villa, in that it has these two things of these like wonderful spectacle, beauty, relaxation, parties, but also that you can be completely alone and ignore everyone else there as well.
Yeah, lots of little rooms that, yeah. where he can be a Stoic philosopher off on his own.
Yeah, and in the in Hadrian's one, it has the most extraordinary of all, which is this enormous room called the Maritime Theatre, in the centre of which is a huge circular pond, in the middle of which is an amazing island, within which is a tiny little house.
It's hermit's hut.
A tiny little house which he can go to and be completely alone on.
In the middle of a in the middle of an island, in a lake, in a theatre.
I think part of the reason why there are so many of these interpretations of Pliny's villas is that it's a type which persists through history.
Intermittently.
But it's a thing which people continue to build. There's a bit in this essay which we've already alluded to which makes this point, which I might just quote. Since it was first fixed by the patricians of ancient Rome, the basic programme of the villa has remained unchanged for more than 2,000 years. The villa is therefore unique as a paradigm. Other architectural types, the palace, the place of worship, the factory, have changed in form and purpose as the role of the ruler, the character of the liturgy, the nature of manufacture have changed, frequently and often radically. The villa has remained substantially the same because it fulfills a need that never alters, because it is not material, but psychological and ideological. This need is not subject to the influence of evolving societies and technologies. The villa accommodates a fantasy impervious to reality.
Yeah, which is that it's a retreat. I think you can agree or disagree with that. I mean, the purpose of a factory hasn't really changed. The shape has changed a lot, but the shape of villas has changed a lot because the idea of what the countryside is and what elegance is and what the good life is has changed a lot. But that it's that the factory is for making things and the villa is for the good life.
Yeah.
Hasn't.
an argument which Ackerman makes, which I don't know whether we're going to agree with it or not, is that the villa is impossible to understand apart from a city. That it. So, I mean, actually, I could do this quote as well. The villa cannot be understood apart from the city. It exists not to fulfil autonomous functions, but as the antithesis to urban values and accommodations. Its economic situation is that of a satellite. So, and he makes the point that through history, there are times when people don't build villas. It basically stops in late antiquity when the Roman Empire ends.
It doesn't work in feudalism.
Yeah.
This thing of, like, long gardens and nice open colonnades doesn't do anything to keep the Vikings out.
No. So when, obviously, there are still aristocrats, that people who are farming the land still have a kind of overlord, but when that overlord has this sort of reciprocal duty to them to provide protection and armies and kind of local, use of violence.
And also, when what they're really interested in is violence.
Yeah.
When that is the, like, linchpin of their culture, they tend to do a lot more recreational violence, which has a very deleterious effect on soft furnishings and... all the sort of, you know, that babbling pool, you know, with all its carved swans and things doesn't do very much.
Yes. So you have
a lovely. That is a lovely thing to be smashed up. The person would say, "Never before have I smashed something up with such, you know, aplomb." And then go on, and then it wouldn't be anymore.
And when they kind of reappear, it's mostly as part of these kind of mercantile societies. So in the Renaissance in Italy, in the Britain of kind of expanding world trade and the agricultural revolution and these
they
sorts
exist
of things.
Wherever you've got rich land owners in a cash crop capitalist farming culture. That's what I would say.
Yeah. So there is actually, villa owners do still tend to farm. They're not purely living a like rural fantasy. They are actually.
Yeah, and I mean, even Pliny's, I think the Romans are almost exceptional in that, or he's an exception in that he makes his money. Actually, no, it's not true.
No, he has land.
Yeah, he gets it from his uncle. That's why he takes on his name. Yeah. So they all make their money from agriculture, and they make it from commercial agriculture. And the villa's in the middle of your massive block of commercial agriculture. I think you've got to... you've got to have cities for that because they are the... You've got to have cities for large-scale capitalism. Yeah, I think it depends a lot on changing notions of artificiality. The Romans, like, there's nothing more artificial in the sense of something beautifully made by artifice than his bubbling brook of wooden ducks serving up delicious eats. And he loves the foil of a colonnade versus a landscape. Yeah. But it's not like the Palladian villas in that you don't see it as a block on a landscape. Yeah. There's... And it's about flux and not stasis. Yeah. The Palladian villas are very still and careful and perfect and static. And their perspectives are one point. Whereas one of the things that's amazing about the sort of Plinian description is how many points the perspectives have.
Yeah.
It vanishes to the mountains and the sea and lunch and the tabularium and the colonnade.
It's a thing which continues into the present, that modernists also build villas. That Le Corbusier actually did use the word villa for things which he was building.
I've got a question. Do you think the Villa Savoie is a villa?
No, it doesn't strike me as being a villa. Because it's not. It's really it's like a sort of a suburban... It doesn't relate to that. It doesn't relate to the external landscape, or at least in the way I don't remember it having a strong relationship to it at all.
The way in which it has a relationship with the landscape is the enormous picture window, the enormous slot window, which is a like horizontal. So you're always looking out horizontally at the horizon. Yeah. But it relates much more to cars. Yeah. It's like Maison Auto, really.
Yeah, really, like the promenade is internal rather than necessarily relating to the exterior that much. I mean, I'm probably wrong about that, but I didn't feel like it had a strong connection to landscape in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, they tend to crop up an awful lot in magazines, rich people's houses, and then sink forever because we don't seem to be doing them that well. But, I mean, there is another problem, which is that you can't go round them because they're run by plutocrats.
Yeah. I think that if you were to isolate the sort of strains which are still going on in these like super rich people's houses in the landscape, one like strain which was quite en vogue in the time that Ackerman was writing that article was the New York Five, Peter Eisenman, all of these very, very, they're quite like austere in one sense and like sort of super like intellectual academic. They have all of these references to classicism, which is one of the reasons why it ends up in the essay.
There's something that rings a bit bogus.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a duff note, particularly in their villas.
Yeah.
Our age is a great time to be alive. There's a terrific amount of prosperity. But there is no longer the cultural confidence of the elite.
Yes.
No longer do we feel that to be an elite person is to be morally, socially, and culturally superior?
No.
Also, that being elite is inherently good. Aristocracy means the best people.
Yeah, no. So then
we don't think that anymore.
Yes. Yeah, there is a reluctance to assert that they deserve to have all of the money, but they still want to keep it.
But also, the villa is about spending loads of money because it is the correct...
Yeah.
It's all duties. It's all mainly stuff that actually most people wouldn't consider that fun. I'm not sure composing Homeric hexameter and reading Plotinus is most people's... sort of idea of good times. I think I'm probably more the dancing Cadiz girls than the good wine.
And then the other strain, which I think you can see a lot of, is this idea of the house kind of becoming the landscape, which I think is one step further in this like slightly shamefaced ostentation, where the house starts to hide under the ground.
Skulking eco homes.
Yeah, well, they're not all that, not necessarily eco, but they tend to be like
slight, concrete slashes.
Yeah, it's still around.
Yeah,
they build them in Russia and
lots around. What's the Ring Road called in Moscow, where all the dictators go when they've been kicked out of countries, live in their weird dachas.
Yeah.
Putin's a dab hand at the Baroque, 1,000 room. Erdogan, very contemporary.
Oh, yes.
He's building palaces left, right and centre.
Oh, yeah.
Saddam Hussein,
yeah. It's quite an old school, like proper old-fashioned dictators.
Hollywood.
Yeah.
Golden age thereof.
Yeah.
Up in the hills.
Yeah. But otherwise...
But actually, do you think the car killed them off as well? Speed of transport? The country is very near for all of us now.
I think partly, and I think, in fact, actually, the functions of the villa now are fulfilled by, like, the holiday home. So that you have your, that you might go to, like... Or maybe even the yacht.
I think the yacht might be near.
Yeah.
The yacht might be nearer. So perhaps that is. Perhaps it didn't die. It just floated away. It's an amazing sight. And a note to end on. Going down to Monaco, a brief rain squall. And they all rush out of the boats and dry them off.
Well, that's been fun. Thanks a lot, George.
Oh, excellent. How do we end? Thanks a lot, Luke. And see you all next time. Catch up with us on social media. Yeah. Like us on whatever we've got going by the time this is released. Friend us equally. Review us wherever you got it. Send it to your friends. Live virtuously and scrub up on your Plotinus.